Hi, friends, and welcome to the Experience Our Industry podcast. I am Dr. Brian Greenwood, and I am super excited to be here today with Annalise Tappy. How are you, Annalise?
I'm so well. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's so great to see you. We were just catching up a little bit beforehand, and I went through my whole checklist, Annalise, except for, and then as your name like got halfway out, I'm like, oh my goodness, I didn't verify. It is Tappy. Did I get that right?
You did it perfectly. I'm very impressed because awesome. You can get it on the first try.
Oh, awesome. Very good. Very good. You know, you actually were probably like right on the cusp. Did I announce your name at the ceremony, at the college ceremony? Do you remember that or not?
I don't think so.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Cal Poly, I guess probably like, I can't remember, Annalise, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, they got so many complaints that people's names weren't being read out at the ceremony at the stadium. So they went to 2 college graduations and everyone's name is read out. So we used to read the names in our department graduations. So I would do it like a minor league baseball announcer. I'd be like, Annalise Tappy,
you know, like I feel like that. You would be so good at that.
I loved it. It was like my favorite thing to do. And now they have 2 gentlemen who do it and they just do it in a very deep voice. So they go, Annalise Tappy, you know, it's like booming. And I'm like, whatever they're paying those guys, I could do it better.
Yeah, give me your job back. It was your calling, it sounds like.
It's like I dream of being a public address announcer. I'm hoping eventually someone will hire me. That's my dream job. But
this podcast is a good step there, I think.
I guess it does. Yeah, it's like I have a microphone in my hand. Right.
Yes.
Let's tell the fine listeners out there a little bit about Annalise Tappy. Annalise is a development and events coordinator at an organization called Wild Coast, which I'm super excited to hear all about. And Annalise was a 2017 graduate of our program. So we'll get into some of that. Let's let them get to know you a little bit. Tell us where you grew up, Annalise.
Yeah, of course. So I grew up in the East Bay area, actually, in a town called Pleasant Hill, which is about like 30 to 40 minutes outside of San Francisco. So nice. Lived there my entire life up until when I went to Cal Poly, actually.
Nice. This is really wild how this happens, Annalise. My last podcast interview, and you all will be back to back. He's from Pleasanton.
No way.
Pleasant Hill, just up on the hill above Pleasanton. That's what I
You're not too far at all. They're like, I want to say like 20 minutes from each other, but Pleasant Hill, I believe is more north. Okay. So hit Pleasanton on your way to San Luis Obispo, but we're so similar. My sister-in-law is from Pleasanton.
That's awesome.
Similar names. So very that pleasant.
That is awesome. Yeah. Yeah, Greg Avakian, who is, did you have Greg here in school? Did you have him? Do you remember him?
No, I don't. I don't think so.
Yeah, he taught while you just evidently just didn't.
I don't think so.
Didn't have him, but he is, he was the longtime director of recreational sports at Cal Poly. Mm-hmm. And now he's the director of San Luis Obispo Parks and Recreation.
How cool.
Yeah, he's from Pleasanton, so that's cool. So what was, tell us what Pleasant Hill was like growing up. I imagine that it was not the booming suburb that it is now.
You know, it's not, but it was honestly like the most picturesque place.
Yeah.
It's truly fitting of its name.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, it was a great place to grow up. I grew up with 3 siblings, so there was always lots going on. They're all older than me. Definitely a really, really lovely place to grow up. And my brother recently just moved back to Pleasant Hill and bought a house with his wife, my sister-in-law. So now I have an excuse to visit again because my parents, unfortunately, during COVID, they moved to Arizona. So I've been kind of sad that I can't go back, you know, because during autumn, it's I'm in San Diego, so we don't get a ton of seasons here. But Pleasant Hill, I miss the changing colors and
that's awesome.
I have an excuse to go back.
Well, very, very cool of your brother to do that and give you keep a connection to Pleasant Hill for you. So you mentioned your parents. What did your parents do when you were growing up?
Yeah. So my mom was a nurse. She was a bedside nurse on the oncology floor. And then she eventually moved into more administrative, like chart review. And then my dad was basically a bio, pharmaceutical statistician. So he was like data analysis for Novartis and Cirrus. So a lot of biotech and, you know, medicinal companies.
Gotcha. So you're a full healthcare family there, huh?
I know. And my sisters are both nurses. My brother-in-law's a nurse. My mom was a nurse. So it just totally missed the gene with me, I suppose.
I got you. Yeah. I have some nursing in my family as well. And I just have this like immense amount of respect for the profession. It's like such an amazing profession. And I imagine being an oncology nurse, I imagine your mom is pretty special because you've got to be a special type person to do that. And so that's awesome. And I've got a really good friend who is, does pharmaceutical stuff. He's a scientist. I'm not sure. I don't think it's Novartis, but it's something similar to Novartis. And so, yeah, I have a great amount
That's
of respect
awesome.
For them. Yeah, a lot of respect for them, too, because they're trying to help us cure these diseases that we all hate so much. So
I know one of the pinnacles of my dad's career was working on this, this antibody that they could use in blood transfusions and, you know, a lot of the places in where malaria was really widespread. So that was, you know, just such an amazing thing for those communities. And that was like the highlight of his career. It's just such amazing work being done on that side. And it's totally the future. So yeah, I totally respect my dad for all of that work and my mom. Yeah. My husband's in the oncology field too. He's an oncologist. And it's so beyond me how, you know, as we'll learn in the podcast, my field is just so different from that. But I'm just eternally impressed by people in healthcare and science.
Me too. I couldn't do it, but I admire the heck out of them.
Same with me. I hear you.
I have zero desire, but huge amount of respect.
Look at the whales and the marine life, and you.
Yeah. There you go. Exactly. So let's talk about a little bit about young Annalise. What was young Annalise like? What was your jam? What did you get into?
Oh my gosh. I was so busy. I feel like my parents kept all four of us incredibly busy. I was always running from sport to sport to sport. I played softball and soccer and I did swim team. And on top of that, I was in children's choir. I was, you know, involved in a lot of my school's plays. I played the clarinet my whole life up until I went to Cal Poly, actually. But sports were definitely my stronghold. I started volleyball like later in life, I would say around late middle school. And then that's when I kind of put all my eggs in that basket. And I continued with that. I did a little bit in college for like intramurals and things like that.
Right. That's cool. Well, in being so involved, I'm sure you have a glory days moment from your before you got to Cal Poly. So I like this segment where I get to let you brag a little bit about your glory days. So what's your proudest accomplishment before you made it to Cal Poly?
Oh my gosh. Well, I would say definitely my volleyball career was one of my highlights. I was the captain of my team my senior year and I won a first league all team, which is a district-wide award, and I was MVP of my team that senior year. So I just felt so at the top of my career in volleyball. So that was really, really a wonderful moment. But honestly, one of my my favorite things that I ever did was I was one of the lead roosters in my like fourth grade musical. And whenever anyone asks for a fun fact, that's what I always say. So maybe that is the true highlight. Because
All right. Well, I'm going to put you on the spot. Give us a good cock-a-doodle-doo.
No, don't make me do that. I'll do it when we end. I'll do that, but not.
Okay. That's so terrible. I'm sorry. That's so bad, Annalise. I wasn't going to make you do it. I was just kidding.
No, I love it.
So everyone has a story, right, about how they got down to little old San Luis Obispo, our little slice of paradise down here on the Central Coast. What's your story?
Yeah, so, I mean, the easiest answer, and I'm pretty sure this is a common answer, but my sister went to Cal Poly.
Nice. And you know, it's so many times I hear that. It's amazing.
Right. Because that's what siblings do. They follow in their older siblings' footsteps, you know?
Yeah.
So my sister, Hannah, who is the closest oldest sibling to me, were two grades apart. And she went to Cal Poly. And her and my other sister and my brother were just so close. We're extremely tight-knit. My sisters both live in San Diego with me. So I was very determined to follow Hannah to Cal Poly because we visited her. And of course, San Luis Obispo is like, it's not a hidden gem, I will say, but it's a lot more unknown than some of the other coastal towns. And because of that, it is just unlike any other place. And I recognized that the first time I ever went to visit my sister. So I always knew I wanted to go there.
Yeah, we do have a pretty special place, that's for sure. People well, how do you like California? Are you going to leave? And I'm like, yeah, I'm not leaving California.
California. You know, I'll have to be dragged out of California.
Yes, me too. So, like I said, it's so amazing how many times I hear about following siblings and all that. And you know, I think it speaks to the close-knit nature of a lot of families. And I just love hearing that and having, you know, two kids who are 2 years apart. So it's so great because right now, you know, they're, you know, at each other and constantly bickering and everything. But to hear you talk about following in your sister's footsteps, and I hear so many people, it's really gratifying. And I think it is kind of cool because we do try to make Cal Poly more like a family feel.
Totally.
I feel like that is one thing that kind of sets us apart. And, you know, as we get bigger and, you know, with the pandemic and all, I think we lost sight of that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously we had some transition with Dr. Hendricks, you know, moving on to the dean's office and then having to replace him and all of that. But this last year in particular, it just feels different. It feels like we've got that family feel back. And I think that's so important for places like Cal Poly and San Luis Obispo. So
what's that part, I think, because there's a lot of other state schools that are beautiful and in great locations, but they don't have that vibe for sure. And I think that's one of the advantages of it for sure.
100%. So let's talk about your time here. In looking over all of the things that you did, there's some things I want to ask you about because I think they're really cool. I want to first ask you about how you found the major, how you developed interest in the major, because what you're doing now and what we're going to talk about now, you obviously have a connection to the ocean, a connection to marine mammals, a connection to wanting to help the environment. So I'm curious, you know, what your initial thoughts were in finding the major.
Yeah. So just background, like I was never that person who was young and knew what they wanted to do.
Right.
I'm a very passionate person. So I feel extremely passionate about a lot of issues, but I was never the kid that was like, oh, I want to be a biologist or I want to be an archaeologist. You know, I just never had that in me. I always knew that I wanted to leave the earth in a better place than I found it from a very young age. I always loved wildlife. I loved, you know, the ocean. I loved animals so much. I've grown up with animals my whole life, and they're like my heart and soul. And when I was growing up, you know, we had a big family of six. So we would take, you know, vacations here and there. And it wasn't super plausible to be flying all the time just because that's so expensive. It's a lot to wrangle for kids, for my parents. And so what we would do a lot is rent an RV and just RV around to national parks. And, you know, one of my favorite moments in my childhood is this big, big RV trip we did. We went to Mount Rushmore. We went to Yellowstone. We went to Glacier National Park. We just really took a whole summer RVing around, and I totally just fostered a love for national parks and the park system and being outdoors and nature. And sorry, my cat is always in the way.
We have two of them, so I know.
Me too. This one's very needy certain days, but then other days I don't hear from her at all. So
those two. Yeah.
But, you know, when you love something so much, you just want to protect it. And so that's always kind of the MO that's been in my mind. Like, no matter what I do, I want to be working in some kind of nature or animal or wildlife related field, because that's just the connections that I grew up with. And my brother went to San Francisco State, but he actually did RPTA there. So that's how that's how I heard of it being a major. And he's, you know, 5 years older than me. So I definitely followed in his footsteps in that regard, just like I did my other sister.
I love that. That's so awesome. So you knew about the major from your brother, mm-hmm. and you kind of sought it out. Now let's talk about keeping that interest, that budding interest when you were here of marine biology and of protecting, and protecting the ocean and protecting marine mammals. you know what I'm trying to say there.
I certainly do.
Yeah. So, you know, I know you were involved in a couple of things along those lines. You know, you were a volunteer at the Marine Mammal Center at Morro Bay. And I know you you got involved with a research project, right, with a marine mm-hmm. biologist for the helping to study the Pismo clams, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Tell us about that. Those two things.
So, I took a lot actually of biology and chemistry courses during my time while I was in RPTA, now EIM. But so when I was in one of my biology courses, I think it was like Bio 102 or 101, my professor was conducting some research on the Pismo clam population, which has been declining in the past, you know, couple decades at an alarming rate. And so I joined his research team to study and learn why these Pismo clams are declining. So we would go out in the morning to Pismo Beach and we'd basically, grid the beach into sections and then count how many Pismo clams we could find. And a lot of times we'd be doing, you know, a mile of coastline and there'd be one Pismo clam. So a lot of it was very, you know, semi-mundane research work, but it was super valuable. And I definitely, you know, again, because I was feeling out exactly what I wanted to do, I loved the, parks administration part of the major, but I wanted to keep on my, you know, knowledge of conservation and marine conservation. So that was kind of my way of doing that, by taking biology courses where I could and helping in those ways.
Yeah, love it. That's awesome. And then the Marine Mammal Center, you were a volunteer. What did you do there? Was that more like environmental education? What did you do?
Yeah, so that had a couple components to it. One was definitely education. So we would, do outreach opportunities with the community to ensure that people were aware of the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which means you can't be a certain distance from marine mammals. Yeah. A lot of, you know, a big issue with marine mammals is people invade their space, especially sea lions and seals, and they get bit. We would basically, the premise of the Marine Mammal Center is they respond to cases of stranded or stressed marine mammals. So those could be otters that are on the shore, they can't get back into the ocean, or sea lions that are being distressed by too many people around, you know, washed up washed up any kind of marine mammal, we would respond and essentially take them back to the rehabilitation center, rehabilitate mm-hmm. them, and then release them, or just find a way to relocate them to an area that wasn't so dangerous for whatever, you know, they were undergoing. So it was a lot of education, because people will come up to like a sea lion and try to get a selfie with it. Yeah. And so we would respond to people getting bit by sea lions, and the sea lions, you know, can be aggressive, but you're legally supposed to be keeping your distance from them. So it was the rescue component and then education and outreach component too. And that was a really, really cool job. So a lot of my roles were like making food for the marine mammals that were at the rehabilitation center. Yeah. Kind of dirty work sometimes, things like that, but it was great.
I bet. Well, I like to give people a chance to talk about their experience at Cal Poly and, enduring memories. Do you have an enduring memory that you'll never forget of your time here at Cal Poly?
Yeah, I think that my most precious memory from Cal Poly is not a specific memory, so to speak, but my freshman year, I actually roomed with my high school best friend. We grew up down the streets from each other in Pleasant Hill, and then went to Cal Poly together and roomed together. So really went outside my comfort zone.
Yes. Well, we have that in common. My best friend since third grade, we lived in the dorm together.
It was the best. So
yeah.
Freshman year we were roomed together, and we just happened to be placed on the same dorm floor as, you know, quite a few other girls who just we clicked with like automatically, immediately. And awesome. That friend group that I made randomly on the dorm floor to this day is still like some of my best friends. And we did everything together. We lived in a house, the five of us, for, you know, the remaining time at Cal Poly. And it was literally like waking up was the best day ever, because my best friends were there and we did everything together. Yeah. We shared everything. And so when I look back at my Cal Poly experience, I honestly think so much about the friends that close-knit group of girls that I made, and how that was just one of the most special things of my entire life.
Yeah, I love it. And you're making me nostalgic thinking about thinking about it also, and thinking about all the friends that you made. So it's so such an amazing time in life. And it really is. And you know, so those who are out there listening, who are current students, savor it, because it is an amazing time. And there's a tendency to sometimes take the privilege for granted, or mm-hmm. get caught up in the day to day and worries and that sort of thing. But
It's so easy to be stressed about, you know, what's next or the next thing, and you just totally lose out on the mindfulness.
Yeah.
Of the great things that are happening around you. And I'm still practicing that today, but I definitely think that's really important to keep in mind if you're, you know, in one of those time of a life situations.
100%. So let's talk a little bit about your path towards an internship, right? So everyone likes to hear about how you got your internship, what you did, that sort of thing. Was it a springboard? And all of that. So tell us, I think yours is somewhat unique. Tell us about yours.
Yes. Yeah, so I did my internship at the Birch Aquarium at Scripps Institute of Oceanography here in San Diego, La Jolla. And I was in
special about that.
What'd you say?
I said, tell them what's special about that, right? Scripps is one of the world's leading institutes.
Oh yeah.
Right?
It's state of the art, you know, marine conservation institutes. They're doing a ton of research that is very widely, you know, utilized and spread across a lot of different organizations and industries. So that was awesome. And I was an informal educator. So I worked with the summer camp program, and I would educate campers aged, you know, 6 to 14 on different marine conservation topics, and then teach them how to surf and snorkel.
That sounds like so much fun.
So much fun. And the way I found it is I wanted to move to San Diego. I knew that for sure, because again, my sisters lived in San Diego, and I am nothing but a sheep following them. And so
perfectly okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was looking for jobs in this area, and that I think directed my search, but you know, I found the job and it was perfect for me just because of my, you know, background and interest in marine conservation. And also I thought, you know, it's kind of recreation programming, in some element. So I definitely think it was a springboard in the sense that I learned that I don't think I want to be an educator. And I think learning what you don't want to do is just as valuable as learning what you do want to do. So that was priceless. And absolutely, in that sense, it was a springboard.
I absolutely love that. And I think that is such valuable insight, and why you have to get yourself out there, why you have to sometimes take chances with things, because you never know whether you may love something that you didn't think you would, or the exact opposite, right? Like you just discovered. Yeah, same thing for me. My I thought I wanted to be in sports information, and then I was like, oh, this is what sports information is. Yeah, actually, I don't want to be. I don't want to be in sports information.
Absolutely, but
it was so valuable to check off. Yeah. So let's talk about. You know, we won't march through your entire list. I mean, you don't have that many, but let's. I do want to talk about you. You were for 2.5 years. You worked for the San Diego Humane Society. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everyone knows the Humane Society, and that's something that's, organizations that are around the country, if not the world. So tell us what that was like. You served as special events coordinator. Mm-hmm. I imagine you got to do and see a lot during that period. What was that like?
Oh my gosh. Well, I feel so lucky that was my first full-time job out of school, because I ended up joining the annual giving team, which was, you know, a smaller sect of the philanthropy team. And I was placed on a team of extremely high performers, and not only high performers, but it was an all-female team at the time. And they were some of the smartest, you know, most creative fundraisers and, you know, communication managers. And my director was just a genius when it came to fundraising and events. And so for that to be, you know, kind of my first learning experience, I think is part of the reason I am where I am today, because it just totally gave me something to, I guess, dream towards. That when I first started in that role, I was not super confident in myself. Like, I really battled with imposter syndrome, and because I was young, I was the youngest on the team by quite a few years, and I was just green, you know? So
yeah, of course.
I think that if anything, that whole experience just taught me, I guess, how to be confident by the time I left the role 2.5 years later, because I moved out of town with my husband. But I felt so much more confident. I felt so much more prepared for any role. I felt like I could take on anything because, of the events we were coordinating were really intricate. And it was just me and one other girl on the events team. And we were doing, you know, 5,000 people fundraiser walks. We were doing black tie galas. And it just was such a rewarding experience. And I'll always treasure it. And the mentors that I had on that team were just priceless, you know?
Yeah. You know, I was going to say, it sounds like you had some amazing mentors, and that's really, that's really pretty special. You know, I early in my career, I kind of had a little bit of the opposite with a couple, with a couple of leaders where it's like, oh,
okay, wow, yeah.
Okay. They don't really know what they're doing. You know, that's
right.
But I can imagine the power of that, like having someone to look up to who really knows what they're doing. That sounds so powerful and empowering. So that's cool. So, you know, let's go ahead and get to Wild Coast. I want to hear, I want our listeners to hear about Wild Coast, not to fully skip like 2 years there, but and 2 years it included a global pandemic.
Yeah, no, we like to, yeah, I like that out.
Yeah, we can
We can move on. I've talked too much about that.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. So let's, I do want to talk a lot about Wild Coast. Tell us, first of all, what Wild Coast is, how you heard about it. You've been working there now for what, I guess about 4 months or so. Tell us how you heard about it, how you got the job, what Wild Coast does, that whole thing.
Yeah, of course. So Wild Coast is probably one of the most amazing organizations that I've ever been a part of. And I can say that very, very confidently. But Wild Coast is an international team, a 501c3 nonprofit based in Del Mar, San Diego County, and Mexico. So we're a registered nonprofit in Mexico and in California. And we essentially, work in marine and coastal conservation, and we address climate change through natural solutions. So a lot of our philosophy is protecting wild lands, protecting ocean and marine and coastal habitats so that it can't be used as cruise ship terminals, so that, you know, the ecosystems and wildlife that belong to those areas can thrive. We have a lot of marine protected areas that we manage in San Diego, I believe over 7,000 acres. So those are basically underwater parks that, you know, corals and all kinds of sea life thrive in. And they're set areas where people can't poach, they can't, do illegal activities there. So it really protects those areas for generations to come. And we also do a lot of blue carbon ecosystem work. And for anyone that's not familiar, blue carbon is basically any, you know, coastal or wetland carbon storing ecosystem. So for example, how the rainforest stores carbon from the atmosphere and takes it away, lessening the effects of climate change. We do that with mangrove trees in Mexico, and we do it with wetlands here in San Diego. So a lot of the work we do is planting and restoring these ecosystems, so that they can continue being barriers for the communities that live in those areas where there's flooding and there's storm. They provide a natural protective barrier. They're also securing carbon from the ecosystem and storing it for thousands of years. So that's a little bit of what we do, but we do so much. It's really amazing. And right now, one of our big things is we have a trash boom at the Mexico, the Tijuana United States border that has so far stopped over 225,000 pounds of trash from entering the ocean. So that's solid waste that would have otherwise, you know, gone into the Pacific. Yeah. And the most amazing thing about Wild Coast is we just get in there and do things. Like, we don't argue about how to do things. We don't worry about, policy and things like that. We truly find areas that we can help, and we get in and do it while other people are arguing about how to do it. And I think that is just so, like, that is a really fulfilling thing to be a part of, because I've worked in places where I don't necessarily feel the, you know, exact presence of my work being put forth the actual mission, but at Wild Coast, you really see the impact that we're having. And that's just so fulfilling. And that's what I've always wanted for myself and my work.
Yeah. Yeah. So talk to us a little more about that, if you will, Annalise. I think that's one of the things that's really sets the nonprofit space apart. Mm-hmm. Is that you do have this this feeling like you're getting up and making a difference in mm-hmm. the world, right? And I don't think that can be highlighted enough how important that is. And so these last 4 months, have you just felt reinvigorated in life and in a career because of that?
Yeah, it's just a great thing to not like dread your work. It's a great thing to feel okay waking up in the morning and working 5 days a week, because that, you know, can be, especially coming out of college, that can be an adjustment to go full time into working. But I just think, you know, you think about the fact that you're going to be working probably for the rest of your, you know, next few decades at least. And for me, I just have to be feeling like the work I'm doing is mattering. And I think that's a personal thing too, because I've just never purely been someone that is very money motivated, which is why the nonprofit sector works for me. I would never want to be in a field that's, you know, very corporate or where my goal is commission to make more money, because that's just not my personality and that's not what's always been in my soul. I've always just wanted to wake up and feel good about the fact that I'm, you know, contributing towards a bigger cause that's bigger than my.
Yeah. You know, I kind of feel like that. I love the nonprofit space and have been, you know, have had positions with the nonprofit space back in my previous life or previous career. But you know, when I reflect on it and I teach about it, I think about and I'm like, man, you know, I think the one thing that we may have done wrong initially is the typology. Like when you say nonprofit, the vast majority of or a lot of younger people think that that means you're not making any money. It's all it's all volunteer, right? Because
yeah.
And so, like when I teach it and I teach about nonprofit, I read things and they're like, well, it's nice and all, but I have to be able to make money. Wait a second. Nonprofit employees get paid.
So, it's true. They don't get paid the most out of all,
much, but
they do get paid. And if you find a good organization that values their employees, you know, will get paid and to do what you love. And that's
exactly.
A blessing.
Exactly. And, you know, there's obviously costs and benefits for any organization that you work for. But I think for good nonprofits and nonprofits that are out there making a difference in the world, I think a lot of them are very progressive in terms of work-life balance. I want to ask you about that, right? You live in an amazing place. We talked about California earlier. And so what have you done in your short career to find some balance? Because, you know, despite working and doing things that you love, like it can be a lot for when you're working for a nonprofit. You have to wear a lot of hats. You have to keep your phone on at all hours of the day and night.
Right.
So what have you done to strike that balance? You mentioned mindfulness earlier. So I imagine I'd love to hear what you do there.
Yeah, well, I would say that I am pretty good if I'm taking time off or if I'm taking a vacation, I will not be checking my email. And that's because I know that my supervisor has my phone number. If something, you know, an emergency or something that I'm truly needed for comes up, they can reach me that way. But right. I'm not in the habit of being on vacation or time off or in the nighttime checking my email, because I know personally, if I see something that's not good news, it's going to ruin my night. I'm going to get severe anxiety from it. Yeah. And so that definitely detracts from any kind of mindfulness when I'm trying to enjoy my time outside of work. And then I would definitely also say that not all companies, you know, are going to have equitable work-life balances. So I think it is important to, if that's something important to you, to prioritize working for an organization that does value the fact that you are a person outside of work and does value the fact that, you know, people have lives and other things going on and families and hobbies and wanting to exercise and cook. And I think you don't have to necessarily settle for an organization that doesn't allow you work-life balance, because that's the first step, is to, you know, be in a place where you feel like you can turn, not check your email after hours or on vacation. And so I think that's super important too, knowing that you also, you know, you as much as the employer have a choice on finding a good fit for you in that way, which is probably easier said than done, but that's something that I have always prioritized. So for sure that. And then to your point, I had a position where I did feel really on call on the weekends because I was managing a wedding venue. And I wasn't the one on site providing event support, but my team that I was supervising was. And I noticed that just really contributed to, you know, anxiety, the fact that things would go wrong. And I'm a great troubleshooter and I love to troubleshoot, but it definitely, you know, prompted some anxiety in me when I would be trying to, you know, just have my work-life balance. It felt like a stress, like what is going to go wrong? What's going to happen? And sometimes that's inevitable, but when it was every weekend, I definitely felt like that was adding to my anxiety. So I was like, for me, I know that I don't want to be in a situation where I'm on call every weekend.
Yeah,
you know?
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. Well, I appreciate you highlighting that. I want to ask you about challenges and opportunities now. And let's I'll ask you in a second about your specific role as events and development coordinator. But let's talk more about the Wild Coast mission, if we can. Mm-hmm. What do you see as the greatest challenges that when we think about marine life and we think about our coastal ecosystems, mm-hmm. Obviously climate change is a huge problem, of course. Yeah. But what do you see in your role? What do you see as the biggest, who's the biggest contributor or the biggest, what am I looking for here? The biggest boogeyman out there in negatively impacting our marine and coastal ecosystems?
Oh my gosh, that's such a good question. Because I would say for the marine and coastal ecosystems, climate change, you know, which is creating ocean warming, which is creating coral bleaching. Yeah. That's a huge, you know, problem. So there's so many people that have a role in it. And, you know, it's an individual, but it's so much bigger than that. A lot of, you know, large corporations and policy, people in policy, like they're really the people who are supposed to be caring. They're the people who are supposed to be advocating for, you know, a healthy planet so that we can have it for generations to come. And I think that's a huge challenge is a lot of times conservation issues, especially these days, it almost could feel like a lost cause to the general public. And my world of fundraising and events and getting people out to events and to donate, sometimes the fight against climate change feels really vague and it feels really hard to grapple with. And it feels really dooming and scary that a lot of people don't even want to think or talk about it, which I do totally understand that there's a concept called compassion fatigue and humans, they can only take so much empathy and compassion before they really start to burn out. And that was something, you know, a lot of people saw in the healthcare field and during COVID. But I think that's just a huge issue is getting people to not care, because I do think most people do care, but getting them to see it as a more specific threat and not this vague, looming, dooming thing that they can't do anything against. But I think for everything to work, we'll eventually need the people up top to do something.
Yeah, you know, I was like shocked and appalled when I learned that, you know, once you get into international waters for a very long time, and it may even still be, you would know, I don't know. I would like to think it changed, but it probably didn't, that basically ships could dump whatever they wanted. They waste. Like, you mean, if you think about a cruise ship, like where's all that waste going? Oh, well, they just dump it. It's like, what? Well, because the ocean was like, oh, well, it's the ocean's so big that it's like the ocean's not a trash can. It's like not a freaking toilet. Like, and so I heard that for the first time. I was like, you've got to be kidding me. Like, we've done that for years and years and years. And they're like, yeah, pretty much. And then you hear things like, we haven't even like come close to mapping. There's so much that we don't know about the ocean, you know.
I know. It's comparable to space. You know, there's deep ocean that we haven't even begun to explore. And the things like that, you don't see it happening, right? It's happening underwater or it's happening behind the scenes. And so it's just not one of those things that is, you know, sounding the alarms. But as I talked about our trash boom at the Tijuana United States border, there is a huge crisis going on there with debris, solid and, you know, waste debris, in those areas, like a lot of people don't have clean drinking water. The pipe, the sewage pipes burst, it goes into the ocean. So in a lot of areas in San Diego, you can't go into the ocean after a storm because there's toxic waste in there. There's toxic waste in Imperial Beach, the ocean there. There's, it's just, it's a huge issue that's not that talked about. And it's almost to the level of, you know, the Flint water crisis, but because so many people are lacking the clean drinking water, but it's not national news for some reason. So that's part of Wild Coast's work. We're really trying to go in there and find solutions while a more permanent, you know, stronghold solution is found. And we're just trying to bring awareness to the fact that these things are happening. Because as you said, with cruise ships, there's so many things that the public doesn't know that's happening. And I think a lot of people would care if they did.
Yeah, I totally think they would too. And so I absolutely love organizations like Wild Coast and people like you who are out there on the front lines. And I especially appreciate what you said is that you all just do what needs to be done, because there can be a lot of fighting and politicization about it. And back and forth and nothing ever gets done. And so I love that practical, pragmatic approach that you were talking about. So now let's shift it a little bit to more of the positive. Like, what do you see as the opportunities for this space and for, you know, for I guess for nonprofits in general, but more specifically for those protecting the coastal and marine ecosystems? What do you see as opportunities out there?
I think that, obviously, we've had, you know, news and social media and the internet for a while now, but I just think continuing to get, you know, stories out there and the word out, I think especially, and I'm sure we'll go into my specific role, but, you know, getting people to events to see the work and be invested in that way. I think that's a huge opportunity. And part of the great thing of experience industry management is creating, you know, connections and opportunities for people to connect to different causes. And I think that is definitely going to be a really valuable part of, you know, mobilizing the public and the community to protect these really critical ecosystems that are constantly at threat due to human factors.
Yeah, so let's get into that. That's a great segue, Annalise. So obviously, your position as events and development coordinator relates directly to the major and relates directly to what you learned here here at Cal Poly, and you're out there doing it. So talk to us about what you do on a daily basis and talk to us about that transferability of skills. Like, I mean, I know it's not just events and development. It's the management overall of a nonprofit, right? I mean, that's transferable from our major to this organization. So talk about that if you would.
Yeah, absolutely. So as far as my day to day, I work a lot with our donor stewardship strategy. So, you know, whether that is working, I manage our constituent database. So all of our donor contacts, I'm the manager of that system. So ensuring that, you know, we have things up to date, that donors are being properly thanked and in a timely manner, that's part of my role. And then a lot of my day is filled with meetings with partners, potential or current partners. So we're part of 1% for the planet. So we have a few partnerships through that. And part of my work is overseeing those partnerships and ensuring that we are meeting their expectations, that they're, you know, getting us everything that they need to really make that partnership synchronized and successful. And then right now, we're definitely in the midst of planning our big event for the year, which is in June. It's our Baja Bash. So that's, you know, cocktail event, our annual fundraiser. That's the one big event that we do. So a lot of what I do right now is silent auction solicitation, which was, to your other point, this is a good segue. I would say all of those skills are, you know, amazingly were part of the experience industry curriculum. I remember, you know, leaving Cal Poly and starting to do interviews for internships and positions. And I felt so equipped to answer any interview question because of how versatile the curriculum was that I had. Right. We had that class on how to keep our LinkedIn profiles updated, how to write cover letters.
Right.
Dr. Rue, shout out.
Yeah.
That was so transferable. Yeah. That's a real world skill that you need to know. And you often hear like, you need a class on how to do your taxes. And I totally agree with that. And that was that level of it. And then, you know, we had a class on event marketing, which really instilled my love in marketing. And now I'm on the marketing team at Wild Coast. My position is under that team. So that was great. I do a lot of data analysis in my role with donor giving. And that was a part of the Cal Poly curriculum as well, or the experience industry curriculum. And there's just so many transferable skills. And that was the most valuable part of the major, was leaving and feeling like I could answer any interview question that was asked my way because I had the versatility of all those different courses, if that makes sense.
Yes, 100% it does. And I just love it because I think that so many have a tendency to forget about the nonprofit space and, and all of those skills that you learn here in the major, you know, apply to any nonprofit in the world. And so that's one of the things that gets me so excited when I start to talk about our major. You know, it's like, Well, what can you do with that? And I'm like, what can't you do is what I would say.
Right? And I even remember taking a customer service class, and
that
was so helpful in my previous role at Riverside County Parks and Open Space District, because I managed the guest services team and felt equipped to do so. And it was amazing because I always knew my interests. I knew that I loved animals, and I knew that I loved wildlife, and I wanted to help, you know, the environment. And I truly felt like I was extremely well equipped to do those things in whatever role I landed in.
Right. Right. Well, I just love it, Annalise. And I can't tell you enough how much fun it's been listening to you talk and hearing the passion in your voice, and appreciating that we have people like you and like Wild Coast out there fighting for our coastal and marine ecosystems. Let's end with this one. We'll go with what advice would you give junior year Annalise? If you could go back and time travel, what would you tell yourself?
I would say, I would tell myself, or remind myself, that comparison is often the thief of joy. And there is no value in consistently comparing yourself to your peers and others. I think that was something that I really struggled with, like wanting to be on a path that was maybe more seen as normal, or, you know, more standard, just watching other people get specific jobs or, you know, have specific opportunities that maybe I didn't have. And it always made me a lot less grateful for the things that I did have, or, you know, the path that I was on. And once I kind of harnessed that ideology back to the mindfulness thing, I think it just really helped me be more content in my life and my career, and understanding that everyone is on a different path. Some people might get there sooner. Some people might have a great career, but they don't have as great of, you know, they're single, or some people might have a wonderful relationship, but they don't have their career worked out just yet. And no one has it all. And I think that only by growing up could I understand that.
Oh my goodness. Well, I just wrote it. There's the proof that I'm holding it up. We're going to end with that.
Love that. On a hot pink sticky nonetheless.
That's right. On a hot pink sticky note. Comparison is the thief of joy. Annalise Tappy, that is an amazing quote to end with and to leave us with. Thank you so much. It's so great catching up with you and getting to hear your story, and can't thank you enough for paying it forward.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for all you do with this podcast and the students. You're making such a difference, and I just think it's amazing, and I'm so appreciative of you having me on.
Awesome. See ya. Have an awesome weekend.
All right. Bye.
Bye.